Pints in the Corner is a music history podcast about the Channel Club in Boston, Mass. Dinky Dawson and Tony Rain are your hosts. They interview channel performers and workers, bringing out stories and memories of the great music and events that came through this iconic South Boston venue. Welcome to Two Pints in the Corner with Tony Rain and Dinky Dawson. Tony is still recuperating down on the Cape, so Sean McNally, who's been wonderful with us for the last month or two, has been incredible. And Sean is taking the lead for Tony. And we have today a gentleman who was the lead singer and guitar guy and everything for a group called Private Lightning in the early 70s. And then he moved over to the Souls in mid to late 70s. 80s, I should say, not 70s, 80s. What am I talking about? I'm in that different era. So what we're going to do today is talk with Adam Sherman, who had a wonderful, I remember him singing with the Souls a bunch of times when I was at the club, and I enjoyed it very much because the band was so electric, especially that snare. That snare cut through right everything. It was a real good pickle. I mean, and I'm sure Adam had a tough time trying to beat it because it was loud.
you would know.
Well, it was a changeover in the 80s. At least it wasn't gated reverb. And it was just right. A real sound that had come over from the 70s and with a real punky feeling, but wonderful to go with the songs that you did. But let's start this off with Sean asking the questions, because him and you talked for about an hour and a half yesterday, I hear.
And we did.
And he had a great old time. Sean was loving it. It was great because he loves to be able to get the knowledge of all the people that was around at that time period. And so here we go. Let Sean take it over from here.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Dinky. Appreciate it, buddy. And Adam, thanks for making the time to be with us today, buddy. I appreciate it.
Oh, you got it.
So let's go back in time again. You're pretty much another one of those lifetime, I call them, Boston rockers. I mean, you had some breaks here and there during different times in your career, but you started out really early and you're still doing it today. But in between all that, we'll talk about the meat of the stuff in the middle, but in the very beginning, maybe give us a little bit of a background, where you came from, where you grew up, your musical introduction to music, so to speak, and when music became part of your life.
Sure. Well, you know, I grew up on Long Island, right next to New York City and right next to Queens, and started playing guitar when I was about 8, started writing songs almost immediately. I was very into listening to Bob Dylan and Phil Oakes and Buffy St. Marie and the people that were, making music, and I was very turned on, you know, of course, by the Beatles on Ed Sullivan. Like everybody else that's of my vintage, that was a turning point. And, I pursued playing guitar, and I was one of the kids in high school that, for whatever reason, I had confidence that I could sing. And most kids in high school, they don't want to sing. I guess, you know, and I was sort of the only singer. The only one that wanted to sing. So I wound up playing a lot and singing a lot and just took it from there. I got to Boston when I was 17. I left art school to come to Boston. And it was really about the college scene. And this was just as the Rat was sort of coming, you know, was changing kind of from the Rathskeller to the Rat. And original music was just beginning to come into clubs, in New York and in Boston, all booked at that time. You had to be a cover band, pretty much. Right. And CBGBs and the Rat were the East Coast places where that really began to change. And as that took shape, then other clubs, other venues started to foster bands that were writing material. And that was very different. That was a real change.
100%. In fact, let's go before we get to the Boston part of this. Let's go back a little bit further. In your family, both your parents were artists essentially, and they got a piano for the house at one point, and that was kind of your first instrument. But you really got into the guitar. Again, the Beatles, as everybody says, it seems everybody in this program, the Beatles is like the one that, like, oh man, I got to do something different, or that's been right. The way I want to live my life, right? So, right. Tell us a little bit about where your parents, what they were doing back then, and then I know you saw your first show at a pretty young age, around 8 or about 10 years old. How that kind of affected you as well?
Well, my mother was a stay at home mom, and she was a painter, so she would spend her, you know, when she wasn't taking care of me, she would paint. And my father worked in the city, worked in New York at two different places over the years, at NBC, which he worked as an art director there, and then moved to Time Life Books as an art director.
Oh, nice.
What was the second part of that question? I mean,
I know you said you started really young. You started writing songs. You were 8 years, like third grade, basically. But I think if you were 10, you saw your first show. And that really was kind of like, oh, wow.
We got to put a year on that. But I was between 10 and 12, that first show. And the first show was in New York City at the Anderson Theater, which is just down the block, on the next block from the theater that became the Fillmore East. So this was an early rock concert for New York City, and it was Moby Grape, opened by Procol Harum, who was on the charts then, and the opening band was Bat Attell, which is
amazing.
A Boston band that
amazing.
Willie Alexander was in. And I, you know, was 12 or 11 or whatever. I knew nothing about Bagatelle or Boston Rock or Willie Alexander. So it was a real, you know, just one of those serendipity coincidental things that, you know, I wound up moving to Boston and was involved with management from the Velvet Underground. And the Velvet Underground in their final days, interestingly enough, for, you know, if you care about stuff like that, Willie Alexander took Lou Reed's place and was singing in the last year of the Velvet Underground's existence. So interesting that he just that little thread.
Right. Well, there's so many connections that run so deep, right? Like who would have thunk back then? I mean, never mind Willie, but you're into some pretty impressive names in the industry, so to speak. But another introduction to music, you said back then, Adam, was a show on PBS, almost like a precursor, I would say, to like the more commonly known like Wolfgang show or a Wolfman Jack show or Don Kirshner's rock concert. What was the PBS show you kind of got involved with, or at least started watching and became aware of?
There was a show from a New York promoter. He might have been a DJ too, named Steve Paul.
Oh, yeah.
And I just happened to be watching TV on a family night, and this, you know, PBS broadcast a show called The Steve Paul Scene.
Yeah, that's
and,
his club.
Get guests on the show that particular night were Moby Grape, and I'm not sure who else, but Moby Grape blew my little mind.
Yep.
And, you know, that stayed with me. So when there was an opportunity to go see a real live concert, real bands, that was like my first choice. It was like, yeah, man, you know, go to see those guys. And Steve Paul was involved in clubs. He might have been involved with Hendrix or something like that. So he was a guy in New York.
I worked one night with Steve Paul when he was Fleetwood Mac. In Steve Paul's Scene, which was three nights in a row after the Fillmore. And it's a little club in New York City. And the Angels drove from San Francisco. All of them came down. And Teddy Slatus, who was running Steve Paul's Scene, which is Teddy Slatus became the manager of Johnny Winter, Edgar Winter, all that stuff, you know. And the thing was, is that they've never been in New York, these guys. They came, they dropped some stuff off for Peter and the boys from Owsley. And then they turned back in the middle of winter on their motorbikes and drove back to San Francisco. There was 25 of them or something. But they were never seen in New York City before, ever, the Angels. And they all came to see Peter. They loved his play.
Wow.
They loved it. They loved the blues he could play and this, that, and the other. And they just wanted to present what Owsley had sent him to do. And it was very good. And Steve Paul, and we had a party one night with some of the goods that they brought, and Steve was part of it. And we sat in this big circle, and he went off into the la-la land, but a great la-la land. And I thought he was just one of the coolest promoters. I didn't realize he had all that other stuff, what he said, as a DJ and what have you. And
I'm not positive he was a DJ. I just know he was very connected in the scene.
Exactly. You know, that makes sense to me. Yeah. And very connected. And loved by a lot of the people there. So it was good. Anyway, Continue. I just had to throw that in because Steve was interesting.
I love all these little, how you guys overlapped at one point, like, without even real, you know, never mind really local, but the fact that you also were aware and involved with Stephen Paul at one point, that's pretty funny. That's pretty cool. And this is about the time, like you said, Aaron, you're like, okay, so I want to do this. School's not for me. Boston looks like the place to be right now. I think you're 17 years old. You leave home. And then you said there was a connection pretty early on with the Velvet Underground and the manager. Maybe you want to get to that a little bit and where that came up.
Well, it's not a great – I mean, it's sort of another – I've got a number of stories that don't end all that well, but – we were told by a classmate of ours who a few years older than us, who had come to Boston and had gotten involved. He was actually playing guitar with this last version of the Underground. He had a standing offer from the guy who was managing the Velvet Underground at that time. He had a standing offer that if he put together a band, that this dude would manage them. And this guy's named Steve Sesnick, and he's written about in Velvet Underground history books because Lou Reed hated this guy's guts. The reason that Reed, you know, split the band, which, you know, wasn't probably all that smart a move at that point. I don't know. I mean, you know, Lou Reed, I mean, Jesus.
He's got some Lou Reed stories as well, which is great. This will also interact with what you're talking about. This is great.
Yeah. Anyway, so we put together a band with a friend of mine from high school who also came with me to Boston with this guy, George Nardo, who played guitar in that final Underground version. And nothing happened. This manager turned out to be a kind of a crook and a jerk, and that was the end of that. So nothing happened, but it did keep me here in Boston. And I was here for about a year before I responded to an ad in the Boston Phoenix gig section that wound up being the band that turned into Private Lightning.
First of all, you found a creep in the rock and roll business? Are you kidding me?
Good one, Sean.
I know. There's, yeah, you know, it's rare, but you find them from time to time.
You mentioned the Phoenix. We talk about this offline a lot. How important the fertile ground, so to speak, the Boston scene was even back in the 70s. Like you say, before the original music kind of started taking over in clubs, I think led by Jimmy Harold with the Rat. The New York, the CBGB scene really started to happen. It was really Boston, I think, that kind of kicked off the original stuff, maybe more so, at least the same as time as CBGB's, but it wasn't the CBGB that we know today or, you know, heard about years later when it was like the most famous club in the world to so many people. But what the Rat was doing was very unique, and the Boston scene back then, you know, we had these periodicals like the Boston Phoenix, which was like the Bible to anybody in the Boston music scene, whether you wanted to go see a show or you're in a band or looking for bandmates. So let's go back to that part with the Phoenix, how you decided to finally get your own thing going on again.
The Phoenix was the way you found stuff, you know? So I found Private Lightning through an ad in the Phoenix. They were looking for a lead vocalist, and I thought, you know, hey, I'll put my guitar down for the right band. And, you know, that worked out well. I probably was in Private Lightning for 8 years. And then I went right back to the Phoenix again and wound up finding the guys that were at that time called the Meetings and turned into a band that I really ended up loving playing with. And we renamed the band The Souls. And did fairly well in Boston. I also probably put about 7 to 8 years into being a soul.
Yeah, I think both bands were legitimate headliners in town for sure, playing and headlining most of the venues you played at. Let's get back to the beginning. Like you mentioned about Private Lightning, because I think there was something in the ad you mentioned that kind of like piqued your interest, and then you went and met with them, and then you found this is maybe the best for you.
Yeah, they were, I mean, I wish I could remember the specific stuff in the ad.
Now you mentioned Born to Run was a big thing at that point.
Yeah, I mean, that's what was happening was Springsteen was just suddenly he was everywhere with Born to Run. And I and friends of mine were just swept away by that. And so when I was looking for a gig as a vocalist, one of the things that caught my interest, because it was so current at that time, were bands that were interested in Springsteen. And that, I don't think it was in the ad, but I had a conversation with they had a manager actually back in those days, same guy that drove the van, you know, so you know how that is. But you know, I had a conversation where I think they were interested in Steely Dan, and which also was at that time like the best shit that was out there. And
thank you.
Anyway,
that's me.
Yeah. Okay, man. I am not worthy.
No. I think he's got some good stories with them as well.
No, I could tell you, I did two tours with Lou Reed. I did Steely Dan was all mine from 73 through 75. And I made a lot of the records too. I went in there and helped in the studio.
Oh, that's amazing. I had no idea, thank you. I didn't know that fact. So it just educated me.
Well, I mean, the thing is I came into the club for one reason in 84. Is because it was a big venue, all kinds of acts were playing, all different kinds of music, and I wanted to learn what was this four different kinds of damn metal. I knew metal backwards, but I didn't know all the different styles of metal. The you know, when all the girls get dressed up for all the ponce metal, I call it, and what have you. You know, but the thing was is that Private Lightning had a good name before it even came into the channel in 81. And you guys, as Private Lightning, were one of the top bands because every dime you in 81 through 82, you headlined. You even headlined against Face to Face and the Upstairs on 814, 81. So so you guys had a lot going on for you. That's what I remember. And
we did.
And it really worked well, and then it changed. But that's what happens with bands. You change, you get things going. I mean, come on. I mean, that's how it is. You don't usually stay forever, and if you do, you kind of burned out halfway through and stuff. But anyway, go back to it, Sean.
That's good. I definitely want to, I mean, Adam, you know, like Dickie said, he was involved like with early Fleetwood Mac, with Lou Reed, with Steely, like the bands that you're talking about. Just again, I like these crossovers where you guys have no idea that you probably were still interested in the same stuff, and Dickie was actually working on it at the same time, which is pretty amazing. But you said, so that you had a ride for Private Lightning. Where was that, and how'd that go?
I auditioned for them at the In Square Men's Bar.
Oh yeah.
In Inman Square, one of my favorite places that I miss dearly. They had a songbook. I remember we did some Van Morrison, and I think we even tried one of their originals with lyrics that No, I guess I had gone up to Beverly to meet with them, and I suppose we played there, but the actual audition, the hoop that I had to jump through was the gig at the N Square. And
I think within 6 months you guys are playing up pretty regularly. And another thing you guys did early on, which is when the earlier bands do this, was you decided to record a 7-inch.
Yeah. That was what was cutting edge at that time.
We're talking about late 70s, right? Pretty much, yeah, in late 70s?
Yes, late, I would say 70, 77, 78, something like that. There were only a few bands that were recording, and even fewer that were putting out vinyl.
Yeah, yeah.
And at that time, the vinyl choice was a 45. And there were, I remember Fox Pass, the first singles that I knew of that came out of Boston were the Willie Alexander, Kerouac Mass Ave single. And oh, yeah. I think had Jimmy Harold behind it, I believe. I heard that at some point recently. Well, it was certainly in the Rat jukebox from the very beginning of time.
Yeah.
I mean, that was the soundtrack for the Rat. But Fox Pass, Johnny Barnes, I can't think of anybody else, but Willie, Fox Pass, Johnny Barnes had singles out. And Private Lightning, you know, was pretty savvy about wanting to market our, you know, do, you know, get ourselves out there. And it was natural for us to want to, make that commitment. And the first single was a song called Geneva, backed with Tight With You. We recorded it at a studio in Brighton. I can almost remember the name of it. Somebody might remember Jay Mandel, who was kind of a freak, but he was the engineer.
Okay.
And it was, I sent it out to record companies, I imagine.
I think back then, Adam, you were saying it wasn't so much that, I think, you know, a lot of studios are actually trying to find clients at that point, too, right? They were trying to get the client, the studios to get the name out there as well as the bands, right? So they were probably.
Well, I think two things. One is there weren't that many recording studios.
Right.
I mean, because prior to a certain point, recording studios were kind of like a business for jingles and stuff like that, commercial stuff.
Yep.
And bands weren't at that point where they were thinking, you know, going in the studio was kind of a big deal.
Right.
And, there weren't like, you know, on every corner studios, or there weren't like now where everybody, you know, can call, you know, they can have a space and put some digital stuff in it and turn it into a pretty decent studio, and you can get, you get recording. Back then, studios were a big deal.
And also back then, you guys basically had to self-finance all that, because there weren't really many labels out there, at least at that level of where you guys were in the space of how long Private Lightning was around for. You guys really decided, hey, we got something cool going on here. I see these guys in Boston are doing a few, you know, they're doing it there on themselves. Let's get some money together on the studios. So that was also a pretty ballsy thing to do back then.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think. We wanted a record deal, you know, wanted to do it. And so we were, very early on, we were investing in our art.
Yeah, awesome. That's right.
The other part of the whole DIY thing, like the do-it-yourself, was once you got that recording, you started going out and hand deliver them to the radio stations, right?
And then there were radio stations that people listened to back then, which is very different now than all the streaming stuff, and everything's fragmented now because you're listening to this and I'm listening to this, and it's not like BCN and FNX and COZ and all those great, ERS, where you would, you know, you'd be listening to it in your world and I'd be listening to it in my world, and we would be able to see each other on the street. No, you know, hey, we just heard the Cars new single, you know, off their first album on the radio, and everybody's singing it because of the radio stations. Yeah. And that's gone now. That's, you know, largely gone.
Those stations were so powerful, not just for the local Boston bands, I mean, but the reach they had to, you know, the fact that you guys could put your own, and, you know, not the first one, but the second one, and then hit BCN starts playing, you know, your 50,000-watt station, all of a sudden Private Lightning's being heard, you know, after Aerosmith or before David Bowie on, you know, with you know, massive international bands.
Exactly.
That just was such a huge springboard. And we also about the whole fact at that time it was 18-plus drinking age back then, so the college kids were out every night. You could play every night of the week pretty much all around town to get your chops down and get good at what you were doing. So it was a really I guess the scene was just really supportive at that point, where it really was – it kind of nurtured any band that really wanted to try to get out there and do their thing, and you guys certainly had that kind of gumption at the point.
Well, there were a lot of clubs. There weren't that many bands back then. Bands were kind of special back then, whereas it opposed to everybody's, you know, everybody's cousin has a band now. It was a rarity to have a band back then, you know, and so
originals. You know?
Well, yeah, I mean, that was a whole different level even.
Right.
But you had a good chunk of clubs, and then the thing that college town had at that time was that 18 drinking age. So you had all of those young students that were, you know, I mean, that's a lot of years of that got wiped out when it went to 21. So it was very alive, very alive, very young. And people were, you know, communicating, people were connecting. And so there were these things that just would take hold, through the, you know, through the media at that time. So I think the Boston radio scene, was stronger than New York. I mean, New York had WNEW and WLIR, but Boston, you know, blossomed with between COZ, BCN, and FNX.
Right. You know, the college stage, like you mentioned, and obviously not having college gigs, which is another place you could play and make money as well.
And if you had a college gig, you got played on the college station just automatically, right?
So I think the second thing, tell me about that sort of song on the Kite. I think that was the one that kind of got into the, you know, where you guys recorded that and out in the BCN's hands, and that kind of took off.
Well, both Physical Speed and Song of the Kite, which were both popular, were recorded at Longview Farm. They were recorded in those days. If you did something yourself, it wasn't the real deal. In your own eyes, it was a demo. Even at Longview Farms, it was a demo that we were going to shop to record companies in order to be able to make the real recording of it, which is like, you know, you look at that now and you say, that's crazy. You know, that's totally crazy. And I look at those demos, and the demos are better than the record that we made
always,
later.
Always.
Know? Always. Always. And right, Dinky? I mean, always.
It's always. I mean, they try to sweeten it up to make it a standard thing, whereas the artist knows what he or she wants. And and they really do not work like that. They've got a schedule that they want, and the right, this has got to be the right snare, it's got to be the right... This, what's the right snare? What's that all about? You know, and it's just stupid. But the demos always seem to me to, in fact, people put them out later and they get better reception and they get better sales from the demos because they are really raw and wonderful. They're real people doing real stuff. But they're not out of proportion sound or any of that wise. They got the feeling. And whereas they're... they have to be meticulous in there when it comes to a record company. Oh, I've got to have it. Everything's got to be. I mean, we were Steely Dan. We had to come from Los Angeles to see Renee Jaeger and them at DBX to see what's going on with DBX, because every time it hit the snare, it sounded weird. And it was the DVX fault. It's nothing to do with the snare. And when we opened it up and took the DBX off, it sounded wonderful, and it was on the album, and it sounded great. So, right. but the technical things, I mean, you just got to do it. You just got to do it, yeah. And when you do it, you've put your heart in it. And the engineer or whomever's put his heart in it, if they've done the same thing. And there's been wonderful girl engineers that's done the same thing in Boston, you know, and doing really nice stuff. Anyway, go on. I keep going on about it because I'm with you on
that. No, you're good. You're good, man. I love hearing what you have to say.
No, you're right. And it's also, you know, I think at some point labels just want to have you re-record stuff for the sake of getting you in a studio. You have to recoup that money back.
Exactly.
You guys are playing out a little while now. You're getting your stuff down. You're probably writing your best songs. You're getting airplay. Things are starting to really happen at this point. And let's talk about that now. Now the labels do start kind of circling around, late 79, I think it was. I mean, there were some pretty heavy hitters in the industry that started sniffing around. Let's talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, there was a bidding war, you know, which kind of went to our heads. And Clive Davis, you know, people from every record company we played went down to New York to audition for Ahmet. You know, we did the whole thing and we shopped for a long time, and then we got a deal with A&M. I don't know what you want to know here. It's all kind of a drag. We got a deal with A&M Records. The A&R guy that signed us left the company, and we were sort of left floating with A&M Records. And it didn't work out well for us. You know, there's a whole legacy story of going to Montserrat at George Martin's studio, and it's stuff, but it unfortunately, and I don't mean to make the interview short or boring, but it winds up with us losing the deal, you know, putting out a record, having no tour support, no marketing budget, and the record fails and we get dropped, you know. Yeah. So one album on a major label. We were able to work two more years, really pretty good gigs without much of a shift. I mean, we, you know, the album gave us a boost locally. So the ground that we had already covered was, you know, lucrative for us. We could play the college gigs and we could do stuff. But it, you know, an album has a lifespan, you know, and we managed to get about 2 years of good gigs out of that. And then we were sort of back on the street.
Sure. Yeah. And then again, it's such a common story, right? It sucks. It just sucks to hear it over. And I don't want to relive negative thoughts, but it's just like, I can't tell you how many bands that have the same story, whether it's, we got a deal, we're so excited, and all the A&R guy leaves. The guy who's your biggest fan takes off. Or they want to force feed a producer on you that you just don't really feel gets it. Or they just drag their feet, and it's like, let's do this or that. And it's in the meantime, you guys just like aching to get in there and just get your thing done and get on, become the rock stars you want to be, right? Get out there and do it. And you know, like you said, there's some positives. You got a record deal, which a lot of bands didn't get. And it did help you, I'm sure, secure more gigs. You know, Pretty Poly Productions was the big booking agency back then, and they had almost all the colleges wrapped up. So you guys could pretty much play around all over New England, honestly, and support yourselves at that point. You were drawing big, you were headlining all over the place. That led to your channel first show. You played the channel in 81. And you did have an interesting story about what Warren had said to you, because Warren Scott was the booking agent for the channel almost the entire length of the club's existence. And so he brought in Private Lighting. Their first show was in 81. And then subsequently, you guys had about nine different headlining gigs over the years there. But tell us about how you got involved with the channel and Warren.
Well, Warren was one of the booking agents around town that we worked with from time to time. And I believe, you know, he was a sought after booking agent. I think what happened was he got a gig at the channel as their internal booking agent. I believe that's true. You might know different than that, but I think he was in, you know, on the inside with the channel, and he approached Private Lightning and said, you know, would you do the gig? Well, I need you to do this gig. I want you to do this gig. You know, I can get you this kind of money. And then it turned out, and we said, yeah. And it turned out that we were at that time the highest paid local band to play at the channel. And for that first gig, I recall it, you know, it was a very, his cash offer was, you know, excellent. Yeah. So we, you know, I mean, again, you know, we had some good years, man. It's not like everything was a drag, but
the story
just doesn't end well. That's all. So.
Well, to be the highest paid local band, you had some serious competition back then. That's a pretty, that's a nice bragging point for, if nothing else, for a while, you know?
True. It's true.
So then you got into the, you mentioned about after the record deal kind of comes apart and you had interest on another, from another label. You had to get a friend at Harvard. You said it was kind of part of your road crew?
Yeah, well, this guy, Rob Falk, who was a friend of ours, Harvard educated, wanted to become an entertainment lawyer. He was studying, and he seemed like, with this was after the record deal fell apart. Our New York management was in the rearview mirror, and we were trying to figure out how to go on. And I suggested to the band that we invite Rob, a friend, to manage and to help us with the booking and stuff. And we did that. And this would have been an attempt to get a second album out on a major. And we did some demos. He shopped them, and there was some interest from Arista Records. But the general consensus of the record company was that we would need to change our name to be able to continue and revive a career. And we heard that loud and clear, and we didn't want to do it. So that was kind of the end of that story.
Sure. And that kind of, I think at that time you guys essentially were on the downslope, so to speak. And I think at that point, You took a little bit of time off, and you got more into your songwriting and delved more into that, right? And then,
right.
Then we get to the next, your next, you know, act you're most probably well known for. You said you saw The Meetings. Well, ironically enough, The Meetings, I think they opened up the final Private Lightning show. Is that what you said?
That's correct.
Wow.
That's correct. I mean, it just was, again, that kind of mystical, interesting serendipity. Typically was not into taking in the entire sets of opening bands, but for some reason, The Meetings intrigued me. And I watched their set, listened to them, and I thought the band was great. I thought the trio, the rhythm section and the guitarist, I thought were great, but I really couldn't stand their front person. And so that was, that was just in passing. That happened to be the last gig that Private Lightning played. We didn't know it was the last gig, but it was, you know, the end of some string of gigs. And then after that, we would have had some kind of meeting and decided to disband. So that became the last gig. But about a year later, after I'd spent a year without being in Private Lightning and a year writing songs, or really experimenting with writing and getting more serious about that, started to look for a band. And I noticed an ad in the Phoenix. Again, I'm back at the Phoenix. And for some reason, I immediately thought, you know what? That ad is those guys. That ad is The Meetings. And they were looking for a front person. And I thought, now that's cool. Turns out it was, in fact, The Meetings. I went and auditioned. We hit it off. They needed a front person and a songwriter, and it was perfect.
It was a pretty good marriage at the time for both of you. You know, you were writing songs, like you said, they were receptive to your material. You were the kind of front man they were looking for to kind of take them to the next level, and you guys decided to change the name from The Meetings at that point to
Right.
The Souls.
Right.
Excellent.
Yeah.
And that, you know, again, that led to the point. Dickie Mitchell, you had a single called Shoot for the Moon you recorded locally, which was a big radio hit. Also, another important aspect of the Boston scene back then was, we talked about V66, which was
right.
a local video show on Boston, you know, straight TV. It wasn't a paid service. You could just watch it on TV at night and then 24 hours a day for a while, which was awesome. And they did a lot of playing of Boston bands. Maybe, talk about the V66 thing a little bit, if you don't mind.
Well, they were open to, they did a big campaign, and they had, I forget who the famous dude was who was behind it. It was one of the radio guys.
So, yeah, Beedon, right? Beedon?
Yeah, that sounds right. There was some money there, and they really went, you know, they went whole hog. You know, their programming was really intense, and they opened right from the get-go, right out of the gate. They were really supportive of local bands.
Yeah.
And what that did, and at that time, local bands didn't have videos because it cost $1 million to make a video, you know. So, and everybody was like, well, you can't do that. You know, it's going to cost you $1,000. Steve Berkowitz, who was a road manager for the Cars, and Jeff Hudson, who was a video producer for, not a video producer, but taught video and produced, I mean, was it in his own right, a video director and taught at the Museum School. They formed a partnership and started pitching to bands, affordable videos of songs. And so, they were approaching bands of material that they had heard or that they knew was there, or that, you know, so Push, O Positive, I forget, it was Andy Mendelsohn's band, something English. They did a bunch of videos, really good, like low budget, but beautiful videos.
Yeah, very, very good quality, no question. Absolutely.
Oh, they're yeah. excellent. All of those videos have stood the test of time. You watch that Push videos, black and white. You know, ours, we did black and white because we loved that. The Push one, I think, was their first one because Berkowitz was managing them. And, and so ours, you know, we made a video for Shoot for the Moon, and V66 jumped on it, and I think you told me that it was the number one video for 5 weeks or something like that.
Yeah, correct. Which is very. They were playing other bands, not just like you mentioned, some local bands, but also, you know, yeah, Till Tuesday was on there at that point, and Face to Face. But even the Cars, they were playing like national bands, and you guys. Mm-hmm. With that video, 5 weeks number one is pretty damn impressive.
Yeah, very impressive.
Yeah.
And again, another amazing marketing tool for the band that really didn't even exist before, that no one thought they could afford. But, you know, like I said, Jeff Hudson and Steve, they had the idea, and what a brilliant idea was to let's help these bands work on a lower pay scale, so to speak. But you got airplay, and that led to more work for those guys. It was a great thing to feed the system and make it work better for everybody involved. You know?
It was, and then the sad part of that story, which is a great story and was a really beautiful little period, is that V66 bit the bullet, went out of business, and that was the end of the local video market.
Yeah,
very true. So you're in the Souls, you got some action for sure. You're getting airplay, you're getting video play. Let's talk about those years. Because I said you guys ended up playing the channel. You headlined the channel. Well, you played the channel 12 times. That went on for a while. And then how does that – again, I'll talk about the negative stuff. But talk about some of the good times during the Souls and when that winded up for you.
Well, the Souls were – I mean, I enjoyed playing with the Souls. We played a lot at played at the channel, you know, all those times you mentioned. We played at Bunratty's probably at least that many times, maybe more. We played up around, there was a club called the Casbah in Manchester, New Hampshire that we were regulars at that club. There's a footnote, which is at one time we were drafted to be Jim Carroll's backing band, and we backed him up on about 5 dates.
Wow.
Manchester, yeah, that was cool. And I don't know. I'm not sure what else to tell you. If you have anything interested in about the Souls in particular, that might get me on a thread.
Well, no, I just know there was you guys had a good run there, and this is like late '80s. I was at the channel at that point. You guys were definitely playing there, and then had a good buzz with the song and the radio. And then I know later on that kind of you got some good opening support slots for like Los Lobos Until Tuesday, you were saying, which is awesome. Those are can't help beating those. You mentioned one show you saw at the channel made an impression with Satellite, Georgia Satellites, right?
Yeah, I fell in love with their song, and I just like, I don't think I really went to the channel much. It wasn't that easy to get to from where I lived. I mean, whatever, I would get, you know, I'd get there for gigs, but trying to think of other shows, but the one that's, that keeps coming back to my mind, I can picture it clearly, was Georgia Satellites doing whatever that song was that stuck in my brain like a...
Hands to Yourself, that was one of them.
Yeah, Hands to Yourself, yeah.
They had a couple. They were a fun band, the club scene. They were a great rocking band.
Yeah, sure. They were a great band, yeah.
And then, so the Souls kind of wind down. You stop playing music for a bit. I think you just kind of were fed up with the whole industry, as so many people do become over time. Just, so the, you know, the ups and downs, and it's mostly downs, and it's... So much is out of your control, which is the most frustrating thing, because you have the goods, you have the songs, songwriting's there, the playing's there, there's interest, you're playing in front of people, and it's like, you know, if the labels doesn't happen, it's kind of like, well, what do we do now? But then you kind of fell after your month into painting a bit, right, for a while.
I ended up painting for close to 10 years. Painting was, I mean, that comes from my childhood. Fine art, painting, drawing, all of that was something that I had always had a talent for, and I'd gone to art school, but I just dug music more. But when the music stopped feeding my soul, really, and just became kind of a hassle with booking, and clubs were dying, and music was changing, and record companies seemed to not be interested, and it just seemed like this is, you know, pointless, and I just needed to get out of it, started painting. Got a rented an art studio, which you could do back in those days. I had a series of really nice art studios, and showed in town,
Right, you said you were painting for quite a while, like 10 years. You did have some gallery showings. And you said during the same time you're painting, you really started listening more to jazz and Chet Baker, for example. Like, let's talk about that a little bit.
Rock and roll is not, it doesn't, for me, doesn't work. The 2-4 drum beat doesn't work for painting. It doesn't go. It needs to spiral more. It needs to be more flowing and interesting and rhythmically challenging, I guess. So your mind is doing different things. So I was, you know, I was listening. I knew nothing about jazz, and I went to some of my friends that did know about jazz and said, "Where do I start? Who do I listen to?" And they said, "Well, you know, there's Coltrane and there's Miles Davis, and and I started listening to all that stuff, and was very happy with that. And then one day it just occurred to me, are there jazz singers? Like, who's a jazz singer? You know, went back to my friends and said, well, you know, there's Tony Bennett, there's, you know, Mel Torme, there's Sarah Vaughan, there's Billie Holiday. I mean, there's, you know, all kinds of this incredible world out there that I knew nothing about, really. So I started listening to jazz vocalists and came upon Chet Baker and just fell in love with what he does, you know, his recorded stuff is just some of the most beautiful sound that I've ever heard. And because I was away from performing and I wasn't really, I had no agenda at all. I wasn't thinking of like, I want to get back. I just allowed myself to go someplace that I really was against, which was, I just said, I wonder if you could sing like Chet Baker, you know, sing like Chet Baker, which really went against my grain. I'm very much into you have your own sound, You want to be unique. You know, you want to be you. That's your voice. But I just sort of thought, I wonder if I could do it. Like, how do you even do it? And so I went ahead and went downtown Boston back in the old days, Boston Music Company, thousands of sheet music bins, and I found my Funny Valentine sheet music. You know, looked like it was printed in 1951. Just brilliant, you know. And I took it back to my, I was living in my art studio in outside Davis Square. I took it back to the studio and had to learn the jazz chords on the guitar. I hadn't really been playing guitar, but I broke out one of my classical acoustic guitars that had a really mellow sound. And I learned the jazz chords. And I sang my Funny Valentine, and I you know, and I tried to sort of sound, use my voice in a way that was smooth, like Chet Baker. And I ended up recording a version of my Funny Valentine on my four-track cassette, little Tascam four-track cassette, recorded that, and then I wrote a song that was in that vein called January, February. You can still see January, February or hear it and see it on YouTube. Jeff Hudson, I went back to Jeff for a video for that. And he made this really beautiful video, which is still on YouTube. And yeah, so I recorded, you know, recorded this on this little cassette thing, and we used that recording to make the video. And then later I went back into the studio to record my first solo CD with Ken Field producing, and we redid that song with accordion and saxophone, and you know, it's like a beautiful thing. We had a backup book, whatever the case is. So yeah, so
that's awesome. And how long, I'm just curious, how long did it take you after you know, getting my Funny Valentine and you know, getting the chords down, so to speak, how long between that and you actually writing January, February, how long did it take you to get your first song written?
Well, January, February had hung around. It had actually, the concept for the song had actually taken hold while the Souls were still around. And it was jazzy to the point that it didn't make sense with the Souls. Mm. So I never really followed up on it. And when I started to open my mind up all those years later to a different kind of thing, that song bubbled up again. And the jazzy quality of it felt like, oh, you know, that's the right thing. And I, you know, it's a song that has the opportunity to treat it with a pure, smooth vocal delivery. And so I would say that it was all bubbling under, and I was probably sort of kind of working on that song. I did a thing with January, February, where I was walking a long distance between work and my art studio, and I started to work on that song in my mind, and I decided I would not write any of the lyrics down, that every day I would try and come up with a new line as I was walking, and I would sing in my mind, and I would walk, or I'd sing on the, you know, I'm quietly on my lips. And if I remembered the line the next day, the line was in the song. And if I couldn't remember it the next day, I had to start again and do that line again. Yeah. And that's how I wrote that song. It's, you know, and it's a sweet song. And I still love the video, which is not the case for a lot of my output, but that video is a beauty.
That's great. And I think this kind of got you the buzz, maybe get back out there. You ended up having a CD release show at Scholars, correct?
Yeah, we did. We did that. We really did that up. Big 9-piece band, I believe, the whole 9 yards, horns and vibes and backup vocalists, grand piano. Special night, very special night.
And it seems like your songwriting was really sparked during this. I don't know, maybe it was during the painting, or maybe you had it all in the back of your mind the whole time. Because not long later, you had another. You wanted to do a solo album, right? And that was River of Dreams.
Yes, and I do think the pandemic played a role in that, or it might have been more in the second. I don't know. I don't think the pandemic happened. The River of Dreams thing is we figured out when we talked the other day that it was 2018 for River of Dreams. Right. Pandemic. So, pre-pandemic. Imagine that.
You said with that, when you did that record, you actually put a band together and played some, you know, a handful of shows around town, like the one small room, the Libby Pad in the Back Bay as well. It gave yourself, I guess, more belief as a songwriter, and you've been really prolific since then, Adam. I mean, really, the last 6, 8, 10 years, it seems like you're just like going and going and going. And in the meantime, too, you're also teaching vocal lessons for the past 15 years or so, right, on the side.
True. Yeah, that's true. Well, the vocal lessons, you know, I feel very fortunate to be able to do that. I feel fortunate to be able to share the stuff that I've gained. I studied with a number of different teachers, so I do feel like I have developed a pretty direct way of helping people to improve their singing, you know, and which is really what I think, you know, you can do as a teacher. Everybody can sing if they will let themselves, but you can do a few things that make you better.
Sure.
Okay. That's really
okay.
What you
guys, we're just about finished today, but I think, Sean, we should have Adam on again because he's got lots of good stuff.
Yeah, we could do that. Yeah, I mean, if your schedule allows it, we can do round two next Wednesday. If your schedule allows it,
that sounds good on paper.
Let's do that next Wednesday at two.
I do have a few other things I want to get into to kind of put the spotlight on. So yeah, that's great. If you don't mind, this has been a quick hour now, and it can just go to tell you things go fast. And
hang on 1 second, let me check something. I just realized that may not work.
Take your time.
All right.
You can always do a different time next week.
How about, let's see, any chance for Monday?
No, Wednesdays.
We're kind of married to Wednesdays with Dinky's schedule, but, you know, the dialysis going on, unfortunately. So on Wednesdays is pretty much his only day.
I have a dead-ass conflict on Wednesday.
Well, then we'll do the following week. What's the following week?
Week looks perfect.
Now, what's that, though?
Yeah, let's do that thing. I do want to get into some other stuff here. I don't know about this broadcast in time, Dinky, but I know Adam's a show coming up late next week. And maybe just mention it just in case it does make the cut, so to speak.
Well, you know, I'd rather come back than try and rush it to get the.
I agree because you're so into it, and it's been good because I see all the progression all these years, and I love it. I think that I think that's the best way to do it, Sean. Now is the 27th? We can't do the 29th.
So I'm looking at Wednesday the 15th.
That's fine. That's
fine.
Works
for me if it's good for you.
Yeah, just put it down at 2 o'clock to 3, and we'll go through exactly what Sean's after. And because it really is amazing that you guys have, what you've done is you've come from a 70s era and put up with 80s in the Boston and created stuff, and now all the way through now to 2006. 26 is you're still progressing, whether it be art, painting, or whether it be singing and writing. And these are good, this is cool stuff. And Sean's got a lot of stuff going on listening to you. I'm like, I really enjoyed that myself and stuff. And
let's for round two, but I also do want to mention this in the interim. So, Adam, you do have a residency going on. Just mention that before you hang up the phone this time. Awesome. And anybody in the area, the Flower Stars down by Harbor Square, it's a really great take. I mean, Adam's had a residency there for more than 3 years now. And a lot of all-star local musicians showing up, a lot of surprises. It's really a really good take. But, you know, we'll get into that more the next time we chat. But, Adam, thanks so much, man, for making the time today. I both appreciate it very much. And we will definitely follow up with a second round very shortly.
Just before we close out, one thing. Do you have a website?
AdamShermanMusic.com.
Perfect. That's perfect, because gigs are, and all your stuff that you're doing, plays here. I just want to thank you. This is Two Pints in a Corner, closing out.